From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environmental and our connections, and our connections with it. I'm Carolyn Murray.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And tomorrow, folks, it is officially the shortest day of the year, just 1 second shorter than today, that is. And as it has become custom with each winter solstice, Brian McInerney joins us to discuss our local and regional weather and climate.
That's right. Brian is the senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service down in Salt Lake City. And he joins us in the first half of the show to discuss this past autumn's weather, just how warm was it, and how Mother Nature's snowmaking machine is performing to date.
And he'll also give us an update on our local watersheds and just how full our reservoirs are or not.
Right. Then in the second half of the show, we'll speak with Kate Bowman with Utah Clean Energy. The Utah solar energy industry is under threat with Rocky Mountain Power's recent proposal to increase both fixed and operational fees on individual solar systems.
Kate is going to give us an update on the Public Service Commission's review of this proposal, and she'll also talk about Utah Clean Energy's recent release of their 10-year solar deployment energy plan, which that sounds kind of intimidating to me. But anyway, this basically talks about the solar market, what it's facing going forward, strategies that can help us overcome those challenges,
right,
and ensure continued market growth.
That's the important point. Solar can still work in this state, and it will work in this state. Now, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Ellen from Recycle Utah. Did you know Recycle Utah accepts and sells used moving boxes, packing peanuts, and bubble wrap? If you have recently moved or are planning a move, stop by our warehouse thrift shop.
Recycle Utah is your local nonprofit recycling drop-off center, bringing water conservation ideas to you for now 25 years. We support KPCW and the idea of leading sustainable lives in Park City.
Burr! Another holiday is fast approaching at Park City Nursery. We are happy to celebrate the changing season with KPCW, offering a selection of fresh field-grown Christmas trees, handmade wreaths and garland, decorations, candles, gifts, and a cup of hot cider. A family tradition since 1983. ParkCityNursery.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Now, Larson is away this week on assignment, so joining me as co-host is Carolyn Murray.
Thank you. Happy to be here, Chris.
Yeah, thanks.
And really excited that I get to be here on the solstice with Brian McInerney.
On the solstice.
That's
a good way of putting it.
Yes.
Because Brian joins us every solstice and every equinox. He just shows up in the studio like those four events. And so we have to put him on. Elsie won't leave until. And so Brian is the senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service down in Salt Lake City. And he's here to talk about, give us a little update on this past fall. Brian likes to focus on past, you know, the facts associated with weather and climate. So he talks about the past 3 months, how they looked, how they performed temperature and precipitation wise, and how we're doing in the present. Not too good with the future, Carolyn. Do not ask Brian to predict any weather trends or patterns beyond, what, Wednesday?
Today's different. We'll go beyond that.
You'll
we'll
go to Thursday?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
We'll get to that in a little bit. So anyway, Brian, thanks for joining us. Hey, real quick, here's the numbers. Here's some numbers to consider. This just out, too. Autumn 2016 was the warmest in U.S. weather history. The autumn of 2016 was the warmest ever observed in records going back to 1895 for the 48 contiguous U.S. states. And this is according to NOAA's National Center for Environmental Information. The nation's average September to November temperature of 57.6 degrees was one full degree above the previous autumn record. And we know when we talk about degrees, that's a lot, full degree. That was set back in 1963. It was 4.1 degrees above the 20th century average. That's the 2 degree C roughly tipping point everyone likes to talk about.
Yeah.
That's tipping point numbers there.
Yeah.
Okay. So you concur with that?
Yeah.
What you guys have observed?
Yeah, and we also had the hottest meteorological autumn in Salt Lake City by far. We also have the hottest January through November time frame than we've had back to 1874, and that follows the hottest meteorological summer we had. And we also broke all sorts of records down in Salt Lake City for heat this past summer. And so it just is following the same trend that we've seen 18 months in a row, with the exception of October, where each month broke the prior month's record for the hottest month. And it just continues. December, I think, will back off of that, because mm-hmm. it's been quite cold throughout the U.S. and in Utah with these wonderful storms we've had. But it continues to be hot, and we just are trending in that direction, which is unfortunate.
Okay.
I'd like to ask something, being new to this green earth. But, Brian, when you say meteorological summer, that suggests that there's a different kind of summer besides meteorological summer.
Yeah, you know how we talk about where the sun's position to the earth is, summer starts on a certain day, and it's usually just kind of a middle of the month. Well, to make it easier, they just talk about meteorological summer is June, July, and August. And the meteorological autumn is
September,
October, November, and then it just goes. And it's easier for people to understand where we are, as opposed to a certain day, like, summer starts whenever it does.
Winter solstice.
Right.
Summer
that
solstice.
Kind of thing. People get a little confused. So I think the people who do long-range forecasting, climatologists, try and make it easier for people to understand what the data means. And it works out well.
You said something interesting. The data you guys observe here in Salt Lake City goes back to 1874.
Yeah.
That's 20-some years in addition to the U.S. weather data in general, which only goes back to 1895.
Yeah.
So good records all the way back to 1874.
Yeah, at Salt Lake, they are. They're good records. It's been a good historical record all the way through. That's why we can look at it and feel good about where we are with this. And that doesn't mean in 1874 it was this hot. It means that's when we first started keeping records. So who knows beyond that time.
Can you say generally that, but all that data shows that the decade of the 80s was warmer than the 70s, and the 90s were warmer than the 80s, and the 2000s were warmer, et cetera. And now this, we're effectively six years into this second decade of the 21st century, and it looks like this one is going to be even warmer than the first decade.
Yeah, how we look at it is 30-year averages. And we just came out of 1971 through 2000. So we looked at that 30-year period, and that was considered normal or average. Then you go 81 through 2010, and then we compared that 30-year average. And we did an exercise where I just looked at it, and we're drier and we're hotter from 81 to 2010 than we are from 1971 to 2000. And that will mostly continue as we go.
So So that's a 30-year average. We're using 81 to 2010 as our 30-year average. And that's the normal. So whenever you talk about temperatures above normal, it's that 30-year data set.
Yeah.
In 4 years, you're going to create a new normal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that new normal is going to be warmer than the previous normal.
Yeah, that's what's kind of weird about it. Because then you say, well, what is normal? Do we look at 100 years? Well, the meteorological standard is 30 years. Because 30 years statistically is enough data to give you correlations on things.
But we're going to be comparing warmer temperatures to a warmer normal.
Yeah.
So we may not initially see big gaps.
Yeah.
Like we saw. Okay.
Yeah. So the new normal will be warmer and drier. And so you could say, let's go back to the 1971 to 2000 and compare the data we have now to that normal period, that 30 years.
So you have historical normals.
And your averages will be much higher for heat and less for...
So our historical 30-year normals have been increasing.
Yeah.
Normal over normal, let's say.
Right.
30, okay.
And does that correlate also with national numbers? I mean, how does that look if you were to take the entire country or, you know, the continent?
Contiguous on the bigger 48 picture. States?
You know, off the top of my head, what I would say is when you look at it for temperature, it's getting warmer. But if you look at the southern half of the U.S., it's probably southwestern U.S. especially, it's drier than Pacific Northwest. They might be actually wetter, because when you look at the models for precipitation in the long run for till 2100, what we're seeing is the northern part of the U.S. is going to be wetter. The southern part, especially the desert southwest, will be much, much drier during that time. Park City is right in the middle of those two regimes, but you see the area, we're going to be wetter during the winter times, but we're going to be much drier during the summer times. But overall, it's a budget loss for water because there's much more evaporation during the whole entire year. And it's going to change. It will change from snow to rain during the wintertime as we continue to warm, depending on what we do. If it's business as usual, there's a 12-degree increase in temperature in Salt Lake by 2100 on average. If we get our act together and stop using fossil fuels, it'll be about 7-degree increase in Salt Lake. So when you look at where we are, we just had 21 days of 95 degrees in a row down in Salt Lake. If we are 2100, we're going to see temperatures of 107 degrees for 21 days. If we follow that same mindset, we just add 12 degrees.
And the 90-degree days will be even greater.
So yeah, that's the formula, basically. That's what's laying out for us.
That's when you model Salt Lake City's climate data and input the changes we're seeing with temperature, it's 12-degree increases. So essentially, the climate of Salt Lake City will be the climate of Park City by that time.
Wait a minute. The climate of Park City will be the climate of Salt Lake City.
Sorry, I got it backwards.
But,
right?
The climate of Salt Lake City will be something like the climate of St. George.
Yeah, right. Or whatever
what
is 12
George?
Degrees. However, if we can get our act together, though, and stop burning fossil fuels, it will only be a 7-degree increase.
So
there's going to be problems anyways.
Okay, so 7 degrees are kind of baked into the cake. Use that
because
analogy.
We've already been messing around since 1980 to where we are without making really any significant progress.
Okay.
And Brian, I don't understand meteorologically what's happening with how a certain region can be wetter than normal and another region can be drier than normal. Like, what's going on with that?
So when you look at, this is quite complex, actually, but we'll try and simplify it here.
You have 40 seconds.
When you look at the equator compared to the poles are warming at a much more rapid rate. That affects the change in temperature from what you typically see. The jet stream is a river of air that goes around the northern hemisphere with little wiggles, or used to, and southern hemisphere with little wiggles. And now what we're seeing is that the little wiggles are becoming more elongated, like a sine wave that's getting bigger. And the feeling is it's trying to equilibrate temperature and pressure. And so the sine wave is becoming more elongated because the poles are warming relative to the equator at a much bigger rate. As such, where you get thunderstorms on the equator, that air rises out of the equator. It goes up to the top of the atmosphere, and then they go north and south. And then it descends. Where it descends is where you have the major deserts of the world, about 37 degrees latitude north and south. That line is shifting farther north and then farther south down in the southern equator, the southern hemisphere, because of the energy is pushing that air mass, and then it's descending at a farther northern latitude. So you're going to see the desertification is shifting northward. That's why the Pacific Northwest is becoming wetter because it's going a little farther north. And then where that air is descending is going a little bit farther north also. And it's covering a bigger area. And like I said, this is pretty complex stuff. But think of air rising out of the equator. It's got to hit the top of the atmosphere near the stratosphere. It kind of goes north and south.
There's moisture in that air.
And then it descends. When it descends, you get high pressure. That's the difference. And so high pressure equates to nice weather, blue skies, no storms. That area of high pressure typically has been about 37 degrees north. If you look on a globe, you'll see most of the world's deserts are right about that area. Well, what's going to happen is that air isn't going to descend about 37 degrees north. It's going to descend a little bit farther north. and those areas are going to have more high pressure. And then there's a big complexity. I mean, there's supercomputers trying to figure this out for precipitation. And this is the latest that NASA has shown. And it's actually quite good, but it's really complex stuff. And by no means is this something that's laid in stone. I'm giving you the really simplistic version off the top of my head that I've seen, but things are changing. We're putting more rocks in a river, and that atmospheric moisture is moving around. The jet stream is changing, and that's the difference. It's a change as opposed to what we were typically seeing.
Where can people sign up for your class?
We'll get to that later.
I don't have one of those.
Yeah. This is his class.
Right.
He comes four times a year and gives us a 30-minute class.
See, I thought we were going to talk about happy stuff like the snowpack instead of climate change.
When's the last time we talked about happy stuff?
A long time, but we have happy news right today.
All right, we'll get to that happy news in a bit, okay? Brian McInerney is here with us. He's the senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service down in Salt Lake City. He's here talking about all things weather and climate, temperature and precipitation. Let's turn our attention to, so we all know, so temperature, really warm autumn.
Yeah.
In Salt Lake City. Looks like 2016 will probably be, for the Salt Lake City or the northern Utah, probably one of the warmest years on record.
Yeah.
Which probably beat 2015, which beat 2014. You know, we've seen record after record, year after year.
Yeah.
So that's temperature. Let's talk precipitation. How was the autumn? How was the fall with respect to precipitation?
So if you were to look at a map of Utah, you would see normal to above normal precip in September, and you'd think, wow, they were quite wet.
Yeah.
What it was a one-day event and that spawned two tornadoes and created widespread flooding from Zion National Park all the way up to Duchesne, and it was just one of the wildest weather events. And
what day was that?
14th, I think, of all September.
Right. So middle of the month?
Middle of the month. And like Sunnyside is this little town that got half of their annual precipitation, half to three-quarters of their annual precipitation in one day. They got 4 to 5 inches of rain out of this event. It was widespread flooding. Zion National Park, the Narrows, if you've ever hiked in that area, it typically flows at 40 cubic feet per second. It was at 140, they close it. It went to 2,000 CFS in 1 hour from the intense rainfall.
What?
And that widespread flooding went throughout southern Utah. And then if you followed it, went all the way up into Duchesne. Areas of Price had widespread flooding. They had property damage. They had all sorts of problems. And it was a one-day event. But
right.
Then you look at the average, and it was above average. So if you take away that, it was mostly dry during the fall months.
So when you have like those one-day events, are we looking at blue skies, then just this deluge, and then blue skies?
Yeah.
It's not a buildup. It's not a...
No, it's really just that. We saw it coming. It was low-level, widespread moisture.
So you guys predicted this.
Yeah,
we
were
able to get
coming.
The word out. Mm-hmm. Down to the parks and those areas, slot canyons and such.
We had flash flood watches out for a wide swath.
But those numbers probably even amazed you, you guys.
Yeah, they were big. What amazed me is we have flooding sometimes, and it's localized. You have areas, southwestern Utah, southern Utah. This went almost the entire state. That's what was surprising to me. And during this time, we had two tornadoes that were damaging, you know, destroyed houses. And
where were they?
One was in Panguitch and one was in south of Ogden, and I think it's Far West it's called. And you could see this tornado, and it was just destroying the place as it moved through. We had thunderstorms that were wicked. We had winds. It was really a violent weather system for about a day.
Right.
And that was it.
So overall, you look at the numbers from 10,000 feet, and it seemed like, we had an average precipitation rates and fall numbers were kind of average. But when you look at it as far as rainy day events, just a couple of there, very few, the rest are very dry. What kind of impact does that have on the reservoirs? How are our reservoirs doing?
Our reservoirs right now are lower than they were last year statewide.
Wow.
And that's just due to the hot summer we had, and we had a low inflow again. This past year was 5 years of below average runoff for Utah statewide. And when you think of, we should be incredibly dry in the reservoirs. Well, what we're seeing is conservation efforts are helping.
Yeah.
And then the farmers are getting cut on their allocations. They don't get the allocations that they want when the levels are so low. So they're not as bad as you would think. But when you go by Echo or you go by some of the other East Canyon, they're incredibly low. They're down by about 25%. And we can fill these up in a year with a big year. Like 2011, we had record-breaking volumes of runoff during that time, and we filled Bear Lake, which should have taken 3 years statistically, but we filled them up. It can be done, but we've been in such a dry period that the reservoirs are lower than they were last year, but they're not as bad as you would think.
And Brian, is it all about snowpack when you start talking about reservoirs?
Yeah, it's all about snowpack. Summertime rainfall can add just a tiny bit to the reservoirs. Typically, we don't factor in thunderstorm rainfall because it evaporates before it gets to the reservoirs.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had some monsoonal years that produced a lot of rainfall. People didn't use the stored water, and we also had some inflow into the reservoirs. But overall, it's spring snowmelt runoff. That's what drives our water supply.
All right, we're going to talk a little bit more about that. Snowpack, runoff, and how things are doing right now with respect to snowpack. We're at the bottom of the hour. I want to take a break or two. You got a few more minutes?
Yeah, I'm good.
Right. Speaking with Brian McInerney with the National Weather Service. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back after these messages from our underwriters.
Hi, this is Brenda with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage collection and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Thank you for helping to keep Summit County clean and green. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power offers Watt Smart advice, such as avoiding the use of large appliances like a washer or dryer between 2 and 8 p.m. It helps reduce energy demand and keeps costs down for all of us. More ways to save energy at wattsmart.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak, Carolyn Murray across the board. Nell Larson is away on assignment for the next 2 weeks or so.
What, like in Barbados or somewhere?
I don't know. She never tells me. She just doesn't show. And I'll be away on assignment in Florida in January, so we'll get to that in a little bit. But most importantly, Brian McInerney is here, and he always gives us a rundown on how things are doing here in Utah with respect to temperatures, weather, climate in general. And we before the break, we were talking a little bit about snowpack and snowpack conditions. How do things look so far this year?
They look good. If you're in Utah right now, we're the leading snow accumulator.
Snowpacker.
This winter. Because
really?
When you look at Utah and up into Jackson, those are the areas that have the highest snow amounts compared to median. And when you look at Colorado, they're doing okay, but they're not doing as well as Utah. And then if you go up into the Pacific Northwest and Idaho, we're doing better than they are. So overall, things look quite good. Park City has 109% right now of median. And if you even look down into Brighton is 114%, Snowbird is at 134%, which is fabulous, because usually we've started these years off trying to get to average or normal or median or somewhere in that range.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the Weber Basin, which we're part of, you know, this is all the reservoirs that are Echo, East Canyon, Wanship, over in those areas, We're at 143% of median right now, all when you consider snowpack, which is wonderful. And it's been cold, and it's kept the snow where we want it. The skiing's been fabulous. If you got out on Saturday, that was the powder day after that horrific rain event we had. And then the cold front came in, froze it up, and then we had snow. The skiing was really quite good up high.
So cheerful. This is cheerful.
This is cheerful.
But I'm trying to also, I think our listeners should understand what median means. Are we talking the 30-year trend for median?
Right, 30-year trend. But we use median for snowpack because some of the more gigantic years tend to pull up average when we talk about average. That number gets pulled up. And so when you look at average, our number is less than if we looked at median. That's just due to these extreme outlier events. Median is just when you say if you have 10 data points, or say 11 data points, you look at the middle data point, and that gives you your median. It's a better way to look at snowpack as opposed to average, which you might have 11 data points, but one is way out there, like a 1983 or something, and so it pulls it up. So they look at it using median, and a lot of people have a hard time with median, but if you kind of explain it that way, they get it. And then we're quite healthy snowpack, and that's as of, you know, Christmas time in December. We were here last year, though. November, December, January had really good snowpack. Mm-hmm. And then the high pressure ridge set in February, and then it all went south. The skate skiing track went away like two or three days, and it was really depressing. So we're hoping that doesn't come back. Am I allowed to talk about long range now?
Not yet.
Okay, sorry.
It's about Carolyn? Sustaining.
All right, did you have another question? I do.
Go for it.
Well, Brian said something. Your words, that horrific rain event.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right? Because here's what I wrote down. And this is just based, you know, my observations out my back window at 7,000 feet.
Okay.
On December 9th, the predictions were there was a winter weather advisory out on December 9th and for predicting a foot or more of snow for this area. On December 10th, with a high in the low 30s, right? On December 10th, when the storm arrived, it first fell as rain. The highs in the almost upper 30s during the day. Again, this was at 7,000 feet.
Yeah.
We know that your mileage varies depending on elevation and location.
Right.
But it rained here on December 10th. It's not supposed to rain here on December 10th. Remember like 4 or 5 years ago we had you on and Nell and I were freaking out because it rained on December. We had a thunderstorm on December 3rd or December 4th. Here it is raining at 7,000 feet on December 10th. Is that, you know, you always talk about rising snow-rain interfaces, right? And how that's going to rise over the years or over the decades.
Yeah.
Are we seeing that
happening?
And is this event kind of an example of that?
Most likely.
December 17th, the rain event.
All right. So we
starting off.
Yeah. It started off as rain again. Eventually it turned over to snow, but it rained for like 10 hours of that storm. All right, so this is an example of a rising rain snow line.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
See, if you look at the science, this is where we're headed.
Okay.
But this could have been, I mean, it's rained before we had climate change. That's the toss-up. But we're seeing more of these rain events. The fraction of precipitation in the Wasatch is slowly evolving. From a totally snow-driven hydrology, rain keeps creeping in there more and more, and it's rising till eventually about 2035, 2065, we'll have areas that are 100% snow-covered are now only 50% snow-covered. And it's due to these rain events that we're actually seeing right now. What saved us, though, is this rain event that was high pressure down by the equator that spun up, brought this moisture and brought it up past Hawaii, then it interacted with a low pressure that was just north of it, created this atmospheric river, and the warm rain was was a precursor. And then when the cold front moved in, it made everything colder, the cold front produced snow, and then we had a lot of snow with this.
Yeah.
And that's really what saved us from this last event. But we'll see more of these rain events in the wintertime.
And is that December 17th snow event the thing that put us over the top in terms of our snowpack, how it compares with the median and the area? Was that a one-off kind of thing?
No, you know, we've had a progressive weather pattern. The high pressure hasn't set in this winter yet. We've had storms that have kept refreshing the snowpack, and it's been great. The key is to have the high pressure either gone or retrograded out over the Pacific, and that's what happened. The door has been open, and we've had very good storms all throughout this winter. That was just kind of a topper. We've got another one coming Friday that will freshen things up. It's cold. It's staying cold, and this is what we want. This is helpful. But the rain event was truly depressing. When you think of all that rain, we could have had powder snow during that time below 8,000 feet. We had forecasted it, and it was a Friday afternoon. The cold front got here, and then it just snowed really well. Above 8,000 feet, it was snowing, but it was high-density snow, 12 to like 14%. But then when the cold front got here, that's what really topped it off and made the skiing so good right now.
All right. Just a couple minutes left. Was that your big?
No. I still got it.
Went out, okay. Wow, you went all the way to Friday.
I went to Friday.
You're
going to
go beyond that? Oh,
I know,
my goodness. All right. I'm going to shut up. Go.
So when you talk to the meteorologist that I work with, they look at global patterns. And when you have a low over the Hudson Bay area of Canada, that typically portends to a high pressure over the west. The low over Hudson Bay is not there right now. The cold pool that gave us all these progressive weather patterns was over Siberia. That really, they looked at that and they all said, this is going to be good because it's going to be progressive. We're going to get storms. The highs should be gone. And it worked out. It worked out really well. Now what the words they use when I talk to them again is it's reloading. That cold air is setting up over Siberia again. It's not over the Hudson Bay. This weather pattern globally is very fortunate for us to get more storms, at least for the next 2 weeks to a month. And we talk about this. Long-range forecasting is really iffy business at best. Beyond 7 days, it falls apart mathematically. So you really can't forecast weather beyond 7 days with any accuracy. 5 days is really what we look at.
Yeah.
But now we're talking about going beyond that because we've had such a progressive pattern. The Hudson Bay low was gone. The cold air was over Siberia. Low pressure was out that way, and it changes the positions of the static high and low pressures. We've been dominated by high pressure for the past 5 years. The high pressure has stuck over the western U.S., giving California this awful drought and limited the snowpack that we have because it deflects all the storms up into Canada, and then you get the polar vortex down into the Midwest. That's not the case now. The pattern has shifted. It's much more progressive. And so when we see this, we're much more optimistic that we're going to keep getting progressive weather. We're going to keep getting storms coming through here. And this is really the first time in 5 years that there was some optimism going out that the high pressure ridge isn't going to set up. Last year, we were pretty jacked up because we had a record-breaking El Nino in the equatorial Pacific, and that worked well up through January. But then the ridge set up again
fizzled
in February.
Right out. Yeah.
Right?
So it's interesting. I haven't ever heard the Siberia-Hudson Bay thing. And are there other land areas that kind of dictate different effects of
weather
patterns?
So think if you could tip the globe on its side and look at the pole right center, you'd see it going around in a wiggle. And those wiggles depend on where the high and lows are. The low was always over the Hudson Bay the last 5 years, which then the wiggle would come back to us in a ridge pattern. If you move that out, it's like moving rocks in a river. The river will flow in a different way, and that's what we've got right now.
Mm. Okay. We got to wrap up.
Oh, we can't be done.
I know. We have more questions.
Come on.
Right?
Well, you're going to have to come back the spring equinox.
Right.
When Brian shows up. He sometimes shows up on other shows and say, I don't understand why he does that.
I don't either. Like, you know, and I have stories about the equinoxes. I haven't even gotten to those.
All right, calm down. We'll get you back on in March. Brian, as always, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we hope we see that precipitation falls in the form of snow and not more rain events.
Right.
But
we're
keeping our eye. All right. That's a good
thanks
way to put it.
Thanks,
good
Brian.
All right, thanks, Brian. Let's take a break for some underwriters and sponsors. And we come back. We'll have Kate Bowman on from Utah Clean Energy. It's This Green Earth.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchard from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
G'day, Ian from Campos Coffee. We're new to Park City and a supporter of KPCW. At Campos, we source our beans direct from the farmers and invest in social projects in all our farming communities. Our coffee blends are roasted in small batches and delivered each day. Campos Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort. CamposCoffee.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Carolyn Murray across the board, and also across the board is Kate Bowman. She is Solar Project Coordinator with Utah Clean Energy, and she's here to talk about a couple things that Utah Clean Energy is doing with respect to the solar market, let's say. One of the things that UCE has just done is recently released their 10-year solar deployment plan for Utah. Is that correct, Kate?
Yeah, that's right.
All right, give us some details on what that plan is all about.
Well, we're really excited to have released this plan. And, you know, the reason we developed it is really because the solar market has changed so much here in Utah over the last few years.
For the good.
Yeah, it's growing really quickly. 10 years ago, there were 76 rooftop solar installations. Now the utility is getting applications for 1,000 or more each month. So it's a totally different market from where we were, you know, even a few years ago.
1,000 or more each month.
Applications.
I know.
Yeah. But and so those ultimately go through to become projects. So it's really, really phenomenal growth.
And what do you attribute that to?
You know, the price has really come down significantly. That's the main thing. I mean, we do have really good policies in place here in Utah that make it easy to put solar on your rooftop. And the price has come down really significantly. So people, you know, are choosing to put solar on their roof and generate their own energy because it's cost effective to do that.
And there's there's more of an environmental ethos going around that people want to do the right thing?
Sure,
with respect to
people realize
reducing their fossil fuel consumption.
Exactly. It's a great way to make sure you're generating your own clean energy right on your own roof.
Okay. So that's part of the plan.
Kate, what are the how does an application go to implementation, and what's the timeline, and what are we talking about?
Well, in order to install solar on your roof, you have to submit an interconnection application to your utility, which for most people is Rocky Mountain Power. So that gives the utility the details of your installation so that they can double check and make sure that they can safely connect it to the grid. Because we do need to make sure that when you're installing something that's generating power on your rooftop, it has to be safely connected to the grid so that we have a, you know, reliable, stable grid and don't cause any problems. So it's just the process by which you get approval from the utility to connect your solar installation to the grid.
So it could be unapproved. Or not approved.
Sure. If there's something wrong with the specific location you're at, or, you know, if your installation were designed incorrectly, something like that. I mean, it's up to the utility to make sure that everything's designed safely so that we can connect it to the grid and not cause any problems.
And are the solar companies, there are a number of them now out there. Are the solar companies regulated like a power company is?
Nope. The solar companies aren't regulated the same way the utility is. So, you know, there's a lot of companies doing business here. The market's grown really quickly, and we've seen new companies come in, companies open up, you know, new offices here because the market has been doing so well.
And that's another reason why perhaps prices are attractive, because you have the free market at work. A number of solar installation companies now are at your beck and call, and that can help create value in installing solar panels too.
Yeah, exactly. It's become a pretty competitive market, and you know the price of the hardware, the solar panels, is coming down. But solar companies are getting better at installing systems faster and more efficiently. Most solar companies can install a typical project on your rooftop in a day. So they're, you know, really fast at turning around these projects and getting better and better at it.
So what are the challenges that the state of Utah faces with a continued growth in rooftop solar, let's call it?
That's a great question, and that's really what the we developed the plan to sort of identify those challenges and then identify some solutions.
Okay.
So, you know, really, as we move from a pretty small solar market to a growing solar market, we need to understand how do we keep connecting more and more clean energy to the grid in a way that's safe and it's affordable. And it's fair for the utility and for solar customers and for solar companies as well. So we need to make sure that everybody has access to rooftop solar, or rather to clean energy. So if you can't put solar on your rooftop because, let's say you're a renter or you have a shady roof, really old roof maybe, you know, we want to be sure that everyone still has access to affordable clean energy, whether that's through some sort of offsite solar farm or, you know, a project like that. And some people can't afford the upfront cost of, you know, buying a rooftop solar installation when you're essentially pre-purchasing 25 or more years of your energy upfront. So if you don't have the capital to make that upfront investment, we need financing solutions so that you can afford to put solar on your rooftop even if you can't buy the whole installation outright. So making sure that, you know, everybody has fair access to the solar market is a challenge that we face.
So, Kate, is that a typical return, 25 years?
Right now, we're seeing much quicker returns. Depending on how much energy you use, it might be 7 to 12 years, something like that.
Right.
So it's a pretty good return on your investment if you think you'll be in the house for that long.
Okay, so like me, I can't put panels on my roof. It's just not, well, HOA issues and the roof is small. There's a number of reasons why it just doesn't work for me. But I did subscribe to Rocky Mountains Power's subscriber solar program. The commercial side of that program sold out a while ago. The residential side of it also sold out, I believe. Is that correct?
That's right.
So there's, you can't subscribe
last
anymore.
Month, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just recently.
But I signed up for it back in September, and it goes into effect January 1st. I will start to see a little line item probably on my bill, monthly bill, that shows me as being a solar subscriber member, and I'm going to pay a little premium for my electricity that I use because it's coming from a solar farm, coming from a solar farm down in Holden, Utah. And Rocky Mountain Power is a big proponent of solar farms. Hopefully they will build more because they have such demand. Are you guys have an awareness of how much demand Rocky Mountain Power is seeing for subscribed solar like that?
Yeah, that's a great program, and it really does show that there's a ton of demand for a project like that. And you know, it was it's a big project. It's 20 megawatts, and
do you know how many acres that is?
You know, I don't know the size. Right. I'm sure it's a lot. Yeah, it's big.
Hundreds of acres. It's big.
Yeah.
But 20 megawatts is a lot of energy being produced there.
Yeah, and you know, it's something new and different for Rocky Mountain Power, so I think there was some uncertainty about how popular it would be, and so it was really great to see it sell out quickly. It's too bad for anyone who missed the first round, but hopefully we'll have, you know, more projects like that in the future.
Actually, you can still register for it. And so by doing so, you're telling Rocky Mountain Power, hey, I want to be a subscriber.
Yeah.
So you can still, they'll still take you sign-ups for it.
And you can join a wait list.
Yeah.
And what's the timeline in terms of opening up?
You know, it depends on how, as people drop out, maybe they move out of state or cancel their subscription, spots might open up.
Nice spot. But hopefully, if you're interested, even though you can't subscribe right now, it's closed to additional subscriptions, go on, sign up, let them know that, hey, I want to be part of a solar farm too, so please build another one.
Yeah.
How about that?
So, Kate, I have a little bit of a technical question. My understanding is that energy, the further it travels, the more diminished the wattage is. So how is it that a solar farm is going to be more effective and efficient than, say, having smaller shingle type of solar panels on multiple, you know, areas in a neighborhood so that that energy can just be immediate? And
yeah, that's a great question. So there's a bit of a trade-off there where if you're producing energy close to where it's being used, you don't lose as much transmitting it. And so it's much more efficient to be producing energy right there in your own neighborhood. And then, you know, the other benefit of producing energy on your own rooftop or in your neighborhood is that you have that source of power there as a potential source of backup power. So if you do have a power outage, you can configure it to have emergency backup power to help you power, you know, critical things if there were a power outage. So there's, you know, obviously benefits to having solar close to where there are people who need electricity. But with a big solar farm, you can leverage economies of scale. Like you said, it's really, really large. Typically, the solar farms will actually have panels that are single-axis tracking, so they can follow the sun during the day.
Right.
They can you know, tilt as the sun moves across the sky, so they can produce a little more energy. And then just, you know, like anything, when you build something larger, you can leverage economies of scale. So it's a little more cost-effective. So there's advantages to both.
And let's be clear that because I signed up for Subscriber Solar, my electrons aren't coming from Holden, Utah. It's not like there's a magic wire that sends it. I'm simply supporting the act of putting electrons or electricity.
You're supporting that facility.
Yeah, onto the grid at large.
And so tell me this, are the people that are interested in subscribing the ones that can't access it right now because it's shut down, it's closed, it's overdone.
Yeah,
so are they in turn supporting future solar development? Is that
by signing up?
Is that
you know? I
yes.
think it's showing demand for more projects like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, go back to your original comment. I mean, there's thousands of applications a month being submitted, and that's a continuous growth curve, right? Over the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah, the market's roughly doubled every year for the last couple years.
And that's residential and commercial and municipalities that want to invest in rooftop or ground-based solar in or near their, you know, their location. So, all right, let's spend, we have a few more minutes. Let's summarize or get any update on the proposed tariff and fixed and operational fees that Rocky Mountain Power has put in front of the Public Service Commission to charge some additional fees for future solar owners.
Sure. What,
any updates there?
There's a few things that have happened in the last few weeks. So there was a deadline on December 9th by which the Public Service Commission had to decide whether or not to begin putting new solar customers on a different rate schedule that was different from the one that solar customers usually use. So the Public Service Commission suspended Rocky Mountain Power's proposal to start putting solar customers on a new rate schedule. So what that means is, you know, for the last few weeks, new solar customers have been put on the same rate schedule for the time being as previous solar customers. So it's not necessarily, a big change. It kind of just kept the status quo as it is. And the next deadline coming up is actually tomorrow. There's a deadline to file dispositive motions.
What's that?
So, you know, what that means is that what Utah Clean Energy is presenting and arguing is that singling out solar customers alone to change the way that solar customers are charged for electricity isn't fair, and it's really something that we should look at in the context of a general rate case. So that is to say, we should look at how solar customers are charged for electricity in the context of how everybody's charged for electricity, because there's important questions that we might be overlooking if we just single out and look at how solar customers are using the grid.
Okay.
We really should be looking at how all customers are using the grid and how we can set prices and electricity prices so that we're encouraging all solar all customers to make better, more efficient decisions about how they use energy. So, you know, we're arguing that rather than changing rates right now for solar customers, we really need to look at the bigger picture.
Okay. Is Utah Clean Energy involved in any of these discussions between Rocky Mountain Power and the Public Service Commission? Do you guys have a seat at the table in this issue?
Yeah, we are. We're involved in the discussions about this whole process.
Yeah.
We're really concerned with the proposal that's put forward. We think it would be really damaging to the solar industry, but we're hopeful that glad that this initial proposal was suspended and that we have a little more time to talk about it, work things through, and hopeful that we can find a solution that works for everybody.
Okay, so you're involved. That's good to know. That you guys are in the room.
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
We got just a couple minutes.
So I have a question about the gas extraction industry.
All right.
And the effects that solar energy may have on trade-off, like job trade-offs. For instance, out in the Vernal area, where for the last 4 or 5 years, they've just been in a full-on boom. Things have dropped off. Prices have dropped.
They're in a bust period.
They're in a bust right now. And why aren't solar companies just flooding that area, creating jobs, building solar, you know, farms, creating infrastructure? I mean, they have as much sunshine as they have natural gas.
Yeah, okay. It would be a great area for solar. That's a great question. And, you know, as we're seeing the solar industry grow and bring jobs here, you know, it would be great to make sure that we are ensuring that, you know, the economic development from the solar growth of the solar industry is, you know, spread out fairly across the state. And there's definitely opportunities in places where, you know, for example, power plants are closing because they're reaching the end of their lifespan, they're retiring, where we can make sure that we're, you know, bringing in jobs and that people in those communities are able to benefit from the economic growth that's coming with solar.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great question.
Get to work on that, all right?
Yeah. Okay. And, well, we're out of time, but we do want to maybe have you on another time to talk more about how the new administration in Washington may have an influence on the solar industry, on the gas industry, on the energy industry at large, because they're all intertwined, renewables and coal and natural gas industries. All right. But that's for another time, Kate. We don't have time. But we do have time for let people know. Where can people go to learn more about Utah Clean Energy?
You can go to our website, which is utahcleanenergy.org. And if you sign up for our newsletter, you'll receive updates about net metering and anything else that's going on with solar in Utah.
And this ongoing issue between Rocky Mountain Power and Public Service Commission, solar towers, where's the best website to learn about that?
You know, we have a quick summary of what's going on our website, utahcleanenergy.org.
Okay. And then more details, links.
Exactly. And then we can link you to the
PSC itself.
Relevant information.
All right. Kate Bowman, Solar Project Coordinator with Utah Clean Energy. Thanks, as always, for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Kate.
All right. Got to take one more break. We'll come back. Hey, it's time to wrap up on This Green Earth.
Hi, this is Seth Adams from River Horse on Main, proud supporter of KPCW. We are excited to announce the newest addition to our River Horse family, Provisions, which is located at 221 Main Street at the historic Imperial Hotel. We are on Facebook and at riverhorseprovisions.com.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Time to wrap things up on This Green Earth. As always, thank our sponsors and underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Rocky Mountain Power,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
and Park City Mountain Resort.
Of course, you can email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. Take us out, Carol.
We've got your Wasatch back.
That's right. And this is KPCW 91.6.